He's amused Cam Newton.
Just ask that question one more time.
He's been insulted by Charles Barkley.
When some idiot in the press asked him, if you know what you know now, what you have scheduled this game?
He's interviewed Matthew McConaughey.
I do say go Tar-Hill.
And he's taken on Big Blue Nation.
He's just completely taken the wind out of my sails.
It's time for The Drive with Josh Graham.
We've made it to a Friday drive and to the final weekend of the college basketball season. Where did the time go? That also means the Duke Carolina rematch will be on tap in Chapel Hill. And even though the Blue Devils won the first matchup, and the Blue Devils are playing better basketball than anybody in the ACC right now, you should expect tomorrow to be a completely different game than the one we saw in Cameron about a month ago. Because this game's at the Smith Center. North Carolina's going to win this time. And they're absolutely, positively going to get to the free throw line more than three times. That is going to be a huge difference in the game. You can ask any coach, and if they were being honest with you, they'd say the biggest advantage they have at being at home, whether it's home field advantage in football or home court advantage in basketball, it's not the crowd noise. It's not sleeping in your own bed. It's the human element that comes along with officiating. This is scientifically studied that on calls that are deemed to be close, whether it be baseball umpires trying to figure out the zone or the block charge, the home team always gets more of the 50-50 calls. And it's why you shouldn't expect Carolina to be attempting three free throws again. It's why you shouldn't be shocked that they shot three free throws in the first place at Cameron Indoor. That is going to be the key difference between what we saw a month ago and what we're going to see tomorrow. And North Carolina still leads the ACC in fouls drawn. Derek Lively, fantastic defensively in that first game. Don't want to take anything away from him. But now North Carolina knows what he looks like. And now North Carolina knows what he can be because he's actually played over the last month. North Carolina didn't have that luxury last time. They hadn't seen Derek Lively be that type of an impact player. It's why I love these run it back games. It's one of the things that we've lost when expanding up to 15 teams in the ACC. You no longer have round robins across the board. The run it back game's always intriguing because it's a little bit more of a chess match. Everybody knows everybody. You know the personnel. You know what they want to do. You've seen it. You've experienced it. How are you going to counter? What are you going to adjust from the first game to the second one? North Carolina with Armando Bacot in the post.
Armando.
They're going to be able to figure some stuff out. Also, Pete Nance only had 2 points in the last meeting. Over the last three games, Nance is averaging 16 a game. So expect more from Nance. Expect more from Bacot. Expect plenty more free throws. So Hubert Davis doesn't have to go into the post-game press conference stating facts for everyone. The other thing's this. You can't fake urgency. One team has to win tomorrow, and it's not Duke. One team has to win in order to make the NCAA tournament. Joe Lenardi still has North Carolina as the first team out of his field, and other bracketologists are saying similar things. I think Patrick Stevens with the Washington Post has North Carolina as the last team in the field. They're right on the borderline. If you lose this game against Duke, well, you got to do a lot of work in Greensboro. Why leave that up to chance? You're at home. You've got your rival in your building. Duke, they were the team playing like they had to win the last time they played. They fed off that crowd, which was the angriest, drunkest, loudest I've ever heard Cameron Indoor. Jeremy Roach, he hit the big buckets at the end. One of the returning players from last year. Duke, they got the 50-50 balls. They beat North Carolina on the boards, which is obviously important when you're talking about Duke being the number one team in the ACC in offensive rebounding percentage and Carolina number one in defensive rebounding percentage. The effort was on Duke's side, and being courtside, you got that sense, or I got that sense when I was watching it up close. Carolina's the one that will have the urgency tomorrow. I have no doubt about that. And for the older guys, they have a track record of when their back's against the wall and the pressure's on them to perform, they do so, whether it be at the end of last year in the run they went on in the tournament or just the last week. Winning at FSU despite the fact Baycott didn't hit a field goal, hitting 14 threes in that game, and also knocking down a top 10 team in the country on your home floor a week ago and never trailing in the game. Just listen to Leaky Black talk about that turn of events.
You know, it's a different group of guys, and it's just as soon as we start to care about winning and like nothing else, you know, that's when we really turn the corner. And I felt like with our back against the wall this last 2 weeks or whatever, you know, it felt like it's a different team out there.
And does anybody have a doubt Caleb Love's going to be better this time around? He only had 12 points in Cameron. In his five previous Duke Carolina games, he averaged 20. It just feels like in what could be his last home game, we know it's going to be Leaky Black's last home game, in what is likely Caleb's last home game, he's probably going to perform against the team that he wanted to play for coming out of high school. You probably know the story by now. Duke didn't recruit him because they had Jeremy Roach already signed. So Caleb Love has taken out his frustrations on the Blue Devils, most notably in the Final Four, but also his first time in Cameron where he had 25+. It's going to be a completely different game than the first one. And North Carolina is going to win this time. Still think it's going to be pretty close, but I like North Carolina to win the game by 7. On Twitter, at WSJS Radio, if you want in. It's where we're streaming video as well. Will Dalton, the executive producer of this show.
What's up?
Me picking North Carolina, does that make you feel better or worse about the Tar Heels' chances tomorrow?
I don't know, given your track record here recently.
Well, I was right about Carolina last week.
Yeah.
I was right about the first Duke Carolina game with Duke. See, nobody likes to remember the times that I'm right. It's only the times that I'm wrong that I get dunked on and
you
Sarah McLachlan starts playing. Yeah, you cursed us. You jinxed us. No one ever remembers when you're right, ever.
We suck.
Reese Davis, going to be hosting College Game Day tomorrow. He will be joining this show in about 20 minutes. Next hour, Tar Heel legend from the ACC Network, Joel Berry, will be dropping by. However and wherever, again, you are listening or watching, we appreciate that. Will Dalton and I will both be at the Duke Carolina game in Chapel Hill. Shifting things a bit. Hidden within a lengthy announcement in the last few hours, some significant college football news was announced today. The NCAA's Rules Committee approved a few rule changes that will go into effect next season in order to speed up games. And most of them are mundane. Can't call consecutive timeouts. Yawn. No untimed downs at the end in the first or third quarters. Okay, how often does that happen? But in between those two was something that will actually change college football for the better. Other than the final 2 minutes of each half, the clock will now stop after first downs. Or the clock will no longer stop, excuse me, after first downs. It's going to continue to move, and here's why that matters. The length of games has become a problem. The NFL thought it was a problem 5 years ago. Roger Goodell was out front talking about this. And the NFL's average length of game 5 years ago was 3 hours and 7 minutes. They thought that that was an issue. So they found solutions to that problem, and the games have been shortened. I was at a game this year, I forget which one it was, that lasted 2 hours and 45 minutes. Games going by pretty quickly. Not a lot of time of just sitting around. 3 hours and 7 minutes was a problem for the NFL that they had to address. The average college football game lasted 3 hours and 22 minutes last year. That's 15 minutes longer for those who don't like doing the math, like me as an East Carolina guy. Had to write this thing down. The clock stoppage on first downs was a perfect answer. It's still, you know, going to be a hybrid of sorts. In the final 2 minutes of the first half and the second half, the clock will still stop after first downs. But this is really outside of the final 2 minutes of a half. And they are projecting, this committee, that it's going to shorten games by 8 or 9 plays. That, coupled with some of the other changes, they think will significantly cut into how long these broadcasts have been. Because you have some games, that's an average of 3 hours and 22 minutes. That means you're factoring in the Navy games where they only run the ball and those games last 2 hours and 45 minutes. And then the four-hour games in the ACC where there are 16 reviews. So it might feel small, but this is a big deal. And it reeks of classic negotiation. Anytime there's a negotiation, you have to have some compromise. And all the talk about potential rule changes this offseason centered on one thing that appears to be a red herring now, where after incompletions, they might run the clock. When you hear that, you think, well, that is not good. That would completely change college football. That would change football in general. That's terrible. But sometimes you throw something out there that you don't intend for anybody to agree upon, so that way, the next closest thing to it, they will sign off on. It's like the interviewing strategy that Howard Stern has, where he'll ask a question that's completely absurd and never will expect the guest to answer it. And if they answer it, great. But really your intent is, okay, I know you can't answer that, but let me ask this thing that's also pretty incendiary, but not quite as bad as that one. And they're more likely to answer that question. It's a great interviewing tactic. It feels that they threw the, it was a red herring. They threw the clock's going to run after incompletions out there with no intent that that would pass. So that way they can get, hey, let's stop. That's crazy, right? But you know what's not crazy? The NFL, hey, they run the clock after first downs. Maybe we can do that. And they got that passed, and they're going to sandwich that in between some mundane things about, oh, end of the first quarter and third quarter, no one time downs. But really what this was all about, I believe, is let's keep the clock moving outside of the final 2 minutes after first downs. And this should just be the start. I think you could still cut down on the length of these football games by focusing on replay. That's what the NFL did. They centralized the process. You know what you don't see in the NFL anymore? The referee standing there staring at a small monitor. They instead have people in the booth who do this, and you could do it in real time, and it's all pretty efficiently done. College football hasn't figured that out yet. You've got these refs looking at the monitor on the side or having the headphones on, and also they seem to review everything. You just got to cut down the amount of reviewing you can do in a game. Maybe make it coaches' challenges aside from scoring plays. I think that's the next area you could continue to cut it down. But the NFL knew it had a problem with 3 hours and 7 minutes. College football is at 3 hours and 22 minutes. That's way too long, especially when you're talking about an average. You need to cut into that, and this is a starting point on that. I think this is a good, positive change for the sport.
The Drive with Josh Graham, only on WSJS.
Did you know that in Greensboro, we've got Duke Carolina tonight on ACC Network? The 18th-ranked Tar Heels, coached by Courtney Banghart, will face Kara Lawson's group. NC State in action right now as we speak, and halfway through the fourth, the Wolfpack trails top-10-ranked Notre Dame by about a dozen. And earlier today, Wake Forest, after a miraculous run to Friday of the tournament, including that come-from-behind win against Florida State, they fall against the fourth-seed Louisville Cardinals, 74-48, the final there. Reese Davis will be on site in Chapel Hill tomorrow for College Game Day. He joins us 10 a.m. tomorrow. You can watch ahead of the Duke Carolina game. Reese, I don't know if you're planning to be at the ACC tournament, but just know that that Stamey's Barbecue, it survived the pandemic, and they're going to be in business all next week.
Well, that's great news, because I've dined on that before. Certainly my great friend Jim Donnan, the former Georgia football coach, is a big proponent of Stamey's, and so I'm looking forward to getting there. We will be there starting on Thursday.
Is doing College Game Day at Duke Carolina always a no-brainer for you guys?
Close to it. I mean, you know, we've gotten a little pushback from different fan bases about this one, but here's how I answered that. One, this rivalry is unlike any other in college basketball. That's a cliche, but here's what I mean by it. Even if you're a fan of another team, fan of another conference, more than likely you take sides in this rivalry. When you sit down to watch the game, you tend to root for North Carolina or you tend to root for Duke, and you don't really know why, but it's meaningful to you, at least on some level. And That, I think that's not nothing. You know, I think that's something. And it will be almost certainly either the most viewed or second most viewed to the first meeting game of the regular season. And when you also factor in that my basketball partners probably won't like this, but there's no singular game in college basketball that's as meaningful by itself as just about any game in football season for this reason. One, they play three times the number of games at least. The playoff field is 16 times larger, plus four. And therefore, it's simple mathematics. So if you have something in the regular season that cuts through, a rivalry with great tradition and history, not just because they dislike each other, but because both have been excellent for years and years, if you have something that cuts through, that's worth sticking with. And, you know, with all due respect to, you know, Texas, Kansas, Arizona, UCLA, Pitt, Miami tomorrow, this is still the game that the average college basketball fan across the country is going to say, oh, Duke and Carolina are playing. And, you know, you can say that's a good thing, you can say that's a bad thing, but I just believe it's the way it is, and that's why, that's why I think it is it's important to be here and continue to celebrate the franchise.
I grew up in a bubble here in the state of North Carolina thinking that maybe everybody across the country had rivalries such as this one, and it didn't hit me until my first job out of college was in a small town of Ray, Colorado, the metropolis of 2,400 people on the eastern plains out that way. And I went to one of the two local sports bars that they had, one of the two restaurants, really, and I thought I was just going to feel like home watching Duke and Carolina and nobody else would care. Half the bar was decked out in Duke gear, and it's just something that I haven't really seen anything else like it in college basketball. Growing up in Alabama, did you have a relationship at all to the rivalry?
Well, you watched it. Now back then you might not get to see it every time because some of the Raycom, the Raycom games and so forth,
sure,
was more, an ACC territory type thing. But you watched it. You're certainly aware of it because. But I will say this: when I was a kid, like a really young kid, you know, North Carolina was terrific and Duke was a little up and down, you know, at that time. That was in the 70s. But by the time the 80s came around and Coach K got it going there and Coach Smith still had it rolling here, then certainly it was one that you paid attention to, you know, no matter where you were. That sort of speaks to it. You, among my friend group in college, when you would watch the game, people would be sort of divided. You'd say, why? And maybe there was a rare instance of, you know, my brother or my uncle or whatever goes to Carolina or something like that. But more times than not, it was sort of like, I don't know, I just sort of like Duke, you know? it was just no reason, but it I think it resonates with people for whatever reason. And one of the reasons, I think, is because it's not just two teams, as I said earlier, that dislike each other. It's two teams that have been so prominent on the national stage for so long, put up so many championship banners, had so many iconic players, that very few other rivalries either can match that, or if they can come close in terms of players, they haven't sustained that level of excellence over a long period of time, or they don't have someone in their state, in their conference, in their same 10-mile radius that does that as well.
Reese Davis, College Game Day, tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. He's joining us here on WSJS. You guys announced a couple days ago that Eric Church, who is such a huge Tar Heel fan, will be utilized on the show. How's he going to be worked in? Has there ever been a Hoops guest picker?
I'd have to think back. I've done the show since its inception 19 years ago. I don't really recall a guest picker,
sure,
per se, like we have in football. But Eric has been, I remember an episode of maybe the Tournament Challenge show or something a few years ago where Eric came on, and, you know, that was just like a phone thing. But obviously he's been on the football show and does a tremendous job as the guest picker there. So he'll bring some flavor. We got something special that he helped us cook up that I think the fans on both sides will find fun and maybe a little bit infuriating on one of the sides. That'll be fun.
It does sound like he learned his lesson. Maybe don't schedule concert dates on the day of Duke and Carolina. Maybe something that he learned from last year.
How was he to know? I mean, that has never happened before, you know? never happened before. But, you know, and that's an interesting thing because I don't know how everybody really feels about it. But I know there was a certain sentiment for years among both sides that they sort of didn't want it to happen, especially in the national semifinal. Maybe, obviously, either would take a national championship appearance, but it was sort of the feeling that there was this ultimate trump card that would be played.
It was talked about as Armageddon around here, like doing sports talk. Like there's two things that would generate phone calls regardless of what time of year it was. If you said Michael or LeBron in the same sentence, or you brought up the idea of Duke and Carolina playing in an NCAA tournament game, let alone the Final Four. Like the, most people said they didn't want it because they were fearful of our crown jewel, which is the rivalry.
Right. And, you know, I think the thing is Carolina has claimed two of the biggest trump cards imaginable in terms of bragging rights. And still, here it is. We're here on the last, we'll be on the last Saturday of the regular season tomorrow. And, you know, the rivalry still carries tremendous weight. I mean, obviously the Tar Heel fans will always have those bragging rights, but now they're still coming in here. And the most meaningful thing is to try to win the rivalry game, put themselves in position to make the tournament. And, you know, what happened in the past is something to brag about and think about, but it didn't, you know, it didn't bring about an end or in any way diminish the rivalry.
Last thing for Reese Davis, want to throw something college football at you on the way out. It just feels like the conversation from the rules committee this past offseason, or really throughout the offseason thus far, has been the idea of, oh man, there's a chance the clock might continue to roll after incompletions, which got a lot of people charged up at the idea, but didn't really feel like something that would ultimately pass. Perhaps it was a red herring for what was ultimately passed today, that other than the final 2 minutes of halves, the clock will roll, kind of like the NFL, after first downs rather than stopping the clock in an attempt to try and shorten up football broadcasts, shorten up games that have now, I think last year the average was 3 hours and 22 minutes. Do you think today was a win for college football, that this is a positive step?
I think it was a neither. And here's why. I don't really understand this idea that people who say they like football want less football or fewer, a shorter game. I don't really understand that. You're already investing so much time when you go to the stadium than what's a few minutes. Now, people watching at home, the length of the broadcast, I can kind of understand, but I think they're more bothered by the stoppages. Well, you know, somebody's got to pay the bills, and that's the way it is. But if there could be more creative ways maybe to integrate the commercials, maybe not take them as often, whatever it might be. But back to your point on the field, the incomplete idea to keep it running was dumb. And I'm glad that I hadn't even seen that story because I've been traveling and been at practice. But the incompletion, stopping after incomplete passes was dumb. The not stopping after first downs is fine, but not for the reason people think, at least in my judgment. It's more because I think we have too many plays in the game sometimes. And I know what I just said about less football, but I think you lose some quality because you start wearing out players. And if we're going to extend the season, it's not so much about once the playoff expands. It's not so much in my eyes about shortening the time period in which games are played. It's reducing, at least to some degree, whatever level that might be, reducing the number of plays, which is a number of, I think they have a fancy scientific term for it, but basically reduce the number of potential collisions.
It's a safety issue.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it is or not, but it can't hurt. You know, I think because, like, here's the example, and people are going to get mad because they're going to think I'm trying to say this team wouldn't have won, and I'm not. I'm not saying that at all. If you go back to that great Clemson-Alabama national championship game in 2016 when Deshaun Watson, 17 but 16 season, Deshaun Watson led the late drive and hit Hunter Renfro for the game winner. Through 80 plays, which is far more than you get in almost any NFL game, right? Through 80 plays, Clemson had 14 points. 14. But they ran 19 more plays and wound up, if memory serves, I think with 35. I think they scored three more touchdowns in the last 19 plays, including that last drive. I don't say that to make any kind of excuse for anybody and all of that kind of stuff. I'm just saying that you run the risk of reducing the quality of the game. In addition, when you do that, when you hit fatigue, you're also potentially increasing the risk of injury. So now if you're going to add more games for at least some of the teams, maybe if you can shave off a few plays here and there and get it back to a more reasonable number with these, you know, with the offenses trying to go fast, as many of them do, though most of the defenses have largely caught up to the whole going fast for fast sake thing. You can't really get away with just running the same play six times in a row because you're going fast unless you have somebody outmanned. So, you know, I think that, you know, I think that that could be helpful, but in terms of how much it's actually going to trim off the length of the broadcast and the length of the day at the stadium, I'm not sure it's going to really make that big of an impact.
Reese, really do appreciate how generous you are with your time. Is your son going to be at the game tomorrow? Duke baseball?
No. He's playing independent league pro ball. So he's off doing his thing, training at a Driveline in Seattle. So he's off to where off to the pros and not playing college ball anymore.
All right.
I appreciate you asking. Thank you for asking.
And thank you for spending the time as well. I'll see you out at the gym tomorrow. Thank you for doing this.
All right. Thanks a lot.
No doubt. There goes Reese Davis joining us from ESPN and College Game Day.
Check this out.
We're on at 5.
The perfect blend of sports and pop culture happens this evening at 6 with the Rich Eisen Show.
Okay, let's get this show rolling. Hit
it. Now back to The Drive with Josh Graham.
To simplify Duke Carolina Part 2 tomorrow, three areas that will decide the rematch. We'll discuss the game with Carolina legend Joel Berry in about 15 minutes, but if you want it to be as simplified as possible, this is what you need to focus on. Number one, Caleb Love's output. He's played 6 games against Duke, WD. The magic number is his career average of about 15 points a game. Let's round up and say 15 points a game. In 4 of the 6 games against Duke, he's exceeded 15 points. Carolina's won all 4 of those games. In the 2 games he did not exceed 15, in fact, he scored less than 15, including the last meeting in which he had 12, Carolina has lost those 2. It's an old adage, but it's an old adage because it's true. Your best players got to be your best players. So that's number one, 15, the magic number for Caleb Love. Secondarily, Armando Bacot's free throw attempt.
Armando.
Not percentage, not makes, attempts. Carolina as a team attempted 3 free throws in Durham, which led to Hubert Davis pointing out facts after the game. Just trying to point out some facts. Bacot had 2 free throws in the game. Carolina is 7-1 this year when Bacot shoots more than 7 free throws. When he shoots fewer than 7 free throws, Carolina is 6-7 against high major teams this year. 6-7. So they're an under 500 team when Bacot doesn't go to the line that much. When he does get to the line, they're a very good basketball team. Your best players got to be your best players. Love and Bacot. But the most obvious thing to point to, what's ultimately going to decide this game more than anything else, is the glass. Duke had a rebounding edge of 6 boards in Durham. Is it a coincidence that Duke also won the game by 6? The Blue Devils are number 1 in the ACC in offensive rebounding percentage. That's 5th nationally. They are 5th nationally in that category, 1st in the ACC. North Carolina is number 1 in the nation, number 1 in the ACC in defensive rebounding percentage. That is 10th nationally. You see the matchup. Something's got to give. Duke expended more effort, more care, more want to, it felt like, in getting the 50-50 balls and winning on the boards in the first meeting at Cameron. We'll see if North Carolina has more of that in the rematch. So there you go. The 3 areas. Caleb Love's output, Armando Bacot's free throw attempt, and the glass. The reason I wanted to bring up specifically Caleb, can you see a scenario tomorrow where Caleb's not getting shots up? Please. It's going up. The question is it going in?
Well, that's always the question.
That's it. And against Duke, largely it's gone in. This time, there will not be the passive Caleb Love game tomorrow. His last home game, potentially, and it's against Duke, where he wanted to play. You're not going to see passive Caleb Love. It's going up tomorrow. And that's why it's so key. If you want to distill the game into the most simple factors, those are the three factors. It's NFL Combine Week. The focus has been quarterbacks. It always seems to be quarterbacks. But especially if you're a Carolina Panthers fan, you're looking for a guy. You're picking in the top 10. So you want to evaluate all these players. And all of them spoke today. They're going to throw tomorrow with the exception of Bryce Young, who's going to wait for his pro day. All the quarterbacks spoke to the media. Bryce and CJ don't really seem like they're that obtainable for Carolina. I don't know if, I guess a team would have to pass on Stroud. Young, it doesn't seem like you have a shot for. So the two quarterbacks Carolina has to really vet, Anthony Richardson from Florida and Kentucky quarterback Will Levis. Now, we've already heard from Anthony Richardson how he calls himself Cam Jackson and all that. Oh, a combination of Cam Newton and Lamar Jackson. Okay, sure. Who calls you that? You lost to Vanderbilt last year. Vanderbilt. I wouldn't be in on a top 10 prospect, a top 10 pick, being a player who can't play this year, being a project. But Will Levis, it feels like an inevitability that's who Carolina's going to take. He's got the tools. You've got a staff that you've spent a lot of money on to coach up guys who have skill sets like Will Levis does. There are Josh Allen comparisons that I don't really love because I see the other side of it. Low end, I see it Sam Darnold all over again, but maybe it is Josh Allen if he has a great staff to coach him up. Here's what I know about Will Levis, though, after listening to him today. Will Levis feels himself. Find you somebody who loves you the way that Will Levis loves himself. He's a cocky guy. He had some comments going into the year where he was compared to Josh Allen a little bit and said, you know, Josh Allen actually reminds me a lot of Will Levis. Some combination of that. Other SEC fan bases gave him the nickname of Football Jesus. That's the way he views himself. I was at the Kentucky-Tennessee game, and there were a lot of jokes about Will Levis and how he felt about himself before they got smacked. And I watched that up close, and Levis throwing a ton of picks. I know Scott Fitterer was at that game. It's the first time he ever been to Knoxville. We were able to talk about that a little bit, the Panthers GM. But here was Will Levis talking about Will Levis.
Yeah, I think physically, I just say my arm talent. I think I got one of the stronger arms that's come out of any draft class in recent memory. And then just who I am as a person, kind of my morals, what I stand for, my values.
Not everybody goes through the growing portion of the combine. Why did you ultimately decide?
Because I got a cannon. I'm going to show it off.
If you want to make out what was asked there, he was asked why he thought it was important to throw. Other quarterbacks, you know, Bryce Young deciding to wait for his pro day. And he says he's got a rocket. He wants to show it off. Can you figure out if Will Levis was in a frat? Can you help me figure that out? Because I know he started at Penn State, then went to Kentucky, had a good year at Kentucky, then wasn't so great this past year. Will Levis gives off frat bro energy. It's what he gives off. Dude, I got a howitzer, bro. Bruh, you even lift? I got one of the best arms in recent memories coming out of the draft, bruh. You know? Hey, Josh, where's this show broadcast? Is it broadcast in Greensboro? Yes, it is, Will. Will Levis. I'm not advocating for Carolina taking him. I'm not. But it feels like that's what we're destined to see happen. This might be a little bit difficult for WD to find. How's your search? First off, what did you write in your search history?
I said Will Levis frat.
And what came up?
Well, the first line of this one, fraternity had a culture of haze. I don't know. He might be in a frat.
Yeah, I'm doing some digging. He gives off the vibe.
Either he was hazed or he did the hazing.
He gives off the vibe of like, why are all these Jeeds hanging out at our tailgate? I know I can't say what that stands for. or what the acronym that's short for is, but, you know, it's, he does give off that vibe. Yo, do you know any of the brothers here at the house? I got a big game this weekend. Don't want to be hanging out with any losers. You don't even have any women with you, man. No, you can't get into our party. He doesn't. Does he not give off that vibe at all?
Oh, 100%.
That's him.
That's great. Pay Bro, your cover charge to get in.
There's a 100% chance that he's in the frat house on a Saturday afternoon in the off season on a bench, shirtless, just doing curls. That's him. Nah, man, I just had to get a quick workout in. Let the guns out. You know, gun show. That's what we got. No big deal. Stay humble. My morals. That's what separates me. To recap the week in the most efficient way possible, we'll keep it simple on this Friday. We have a Rhinestone Cowboy Friday coming up as well. But up next, Joel Berry, Carolina legend, will join us to continue breaking down Duke and Carolina here on a Friday Drive.
You're on the drive with Josh Graham, WSJS.
Tar Heel great Joel Berry from the ACC Network going to join us momentarily. He's telling me he's going to be at Pittsburgh, Miami tomorrow. Joel, you are going to be at Miami and Pittsburgh tomorrow. That is a huge basketball game. Like, when you talk about what is at stake this time of year, Virginia is probably going to beat Louisville, which means they will be guaranteed a share of first place for an ACC title. But Miami and Pitt, they're playing for a chance to hang a banner in their building that reads ACC champs, and that's no small thing. But we've got to talk about Duke and Carolina since we've got you here. And since you've been in the battles and you know what the round robin element of this is like, what adjustments can be made, what are some things that you just have to deal with, what's something from an analyst perspective that you saw in the first game that you expect to be prevalent again, and maybe something else you can see not being so prevalent based on adjustments?
Yeah, I think one is for Carolina, they have to shoot the ball better. And lately they have, in their last three games or so, they have been shooting the ball better from the perimeter and getting more perimeter production, not only from the guards, but, you know, the Pete Nance has been shooting it better. So they have to find, they have to first shoot the ball better, but two, I think they need to find a way to get Armando or get Derek Lively off of Armando, whether that be a cross screen and have it to where he can get easier attempts and not having to back down Derek Lively in the paint. Because when you have, when he's attached to Armando that way, it's just too much size and too much length to have to back a guy down. And, you know, Armando's not the most athletic guy. So to be able to have to force yourself through somebody of Derek Lively's size is kind of tough. So being able to find ways to do a brush screen or something to get Armando on the block and get him an easy touch, because Lively did a fantastic job on him in the paint and really took away the paint presence for Carolina.
How do you expect that Carolina is going to use Leaky Black in this game? Because a turning point last year was that Hubert, the first game when they lost by 20, was trying to make Leaky Black a guy who was guarding one player at a given point, given how hot they were, and then would flip it later on in the game. They just decided that, no. Brady Manick, you're the four. You're going to guard Duke's four. And Leaky, even though you're our best defender, you're going to be put on the guy who most reflects, you know, your position. I think he was on Mark Mitchell for a great portion of that game. Given how good Leaky is on that side of the ball, how do you expect he's going to be used? Plus, don't forget, offensively, he was one of the better players that Carolina had in Durham.
Yeah, I think Leaky Black, when he's being aggressive on the offensive end, that's when Carolina has another guy that can score the ball. Now, not from the perimeter, but being able to slash to the basket, being almost that Theo type like player that was for us, where he's not only making plays for himself, but he's able to make plays for other people. On the defensive side of the ball, I like that adjustment that they made last year with Manic guarding Paolo Banchero, because then you know they're forcing it into Banchero, and Brady Manic was just, you know, standing his ground and guarding, and Leaky was staying on the perimeter where he's used to being on the perimeter. I think Leaky is just one of those players that can give you so much, and if he can continue to have that offensive firepower that he's had, that will be a huge difference in this game tomorrow, and gives them another outlet, and it will hopefully look like the Florida State game where you have, you know, your four guys outside of Armando that are in double figures.
Joel Berry's with us here from the ACC Network. Speaking of Leaky Black, it's difficult. See, the awards are going to come out next week, and I put something out earlier this week that I preferred Reese Beekman to Leaky, but would be all right if either won. And it's based on a lot of things. There are less metrics that you have for defense than offense. So usually I'm trying to find the best defensive player on the best defensive team. And Virginia's the best defensive team, and he's the best defensive player. When I texted coaches, some responded with Leaky. Every single one of them included Beekman on their list. It's narrow. But when you watch from a player's perspective, seeing everybody in the league play, how much separation is there between a guy like Reese Beekman and Leaky Black? And is there anybody else we should be throwing into that conversation for Defensive Player of the Year?
It's between Leaky and Reese Beekman, it's a very slim difference. I mean, both of those guys can guard the hell out of the ball, and those are two dudes you do not want to see going into the game, especially if you know you're the man on your team. You can expect to have Leaky or Reese standing in front of you. And when I look at these two guys, it's not just what they've done this year, and I think it's like that with anyone that has spent a good amount of time in one league. You start looking back at what they've done previously. And both of these guys consistently throughout their years have showed up each and every game on the defensive end and have guarded the best players. And to your point, we don't have all the metrics showing how great a defender is. And two, you don't sit on the couch, or you don't go to a game saying, I can't wait to watch Leaky guard somebody tonight. I mean, that doesn't happen. So it's just one of those things that you have to, when you look at the body of work that these two guys have done, you look at what they've done over the period of years, and what they have done is just unbelievable. I couldn't guard like they guarded, but it's very slim. And I think those two guys, if one of those guys gets it, I think everyone in the league will be just fine and say they both, you know, either person deserved that award.
Who did you hate facing the most? Was it Alvarado at Georgia Tech? I know he was the trash talker. Who was the guy that you hated to face the most?
Alvarado was definitely one of those guys. We had our fair share of battles. I think if he still were to walk into Chapel Hill today, I think a lot of the people would boo him. Even though I'm coming up, I'm 5-6 years removed, so I'm starting to get to that old guy, you know?
Uh-huh.
But Alvarado was one of those guys. I didn't like facing London Perrantes and Malcolm Brogdon. That duo was insane. And those are the two guys that comes to mind for me.
Joel Berry's with us here. Where do you stand on – now, there are more counting stats when you get to ACC Player of the Year. Usually you look at scoring average and rebounding and those things. It's – how many guys are in that conversation, and does anybody stand out specifically to you right now going into the last weekend?
Josh, it's really hard. And when I was doing the going through who I would pick as my ACC player of the year, there wasn't one guy that stood out to me.
Yeah.
And it's almost to my point, as I was saying, when in our league right now, when we have a lot of older guys, you not only look at what they've done this year, but you look at what they've done over the years in the league. And one guy that I would choose is Isaiah Wong.
Oh, no doubt.
He has been playing unbelievable. He is a huge reason why Miami is looking to get be an ACC regular season champ. But he has played unbelievable. But, you know, you throw Armando Bacot in there, even though he has fallen off as the year has gone on. But he has showed up consistently each and every night. And last year, I thought that he should have won it. But it's hard to say that, you know, Alondez Williams definitely deserved it for what he does.
So how long? I guess what's interesting, though, what you're saying, Joel, is how long is the list? I had somebody say to me that there are five or six people that going into the last week, whether it's Burton who's leading in like top 10 in five different categories at Pittsburgh, or if it's Ty Appleby leading in scoring and assist, or if it's Bacot, or if it's Wong, like how long is Joel Berry's list? Five, six guys?
Yeah, I can go five guys. I got Isaiah Wong. You can go. I was just getting ready to speak on Ty Appleby. You know, Alondez Williams won it, leading the conference in scoring and assists. Isaiah Wong. You could potentially go like a Jordan Miller. You can go Jamarius Burton. I mean, the list goes on. I mean, there's more guys that you could throw in there as well. But I mean, you know, it's just one of those ones seasons where no one clearly stands out and separates themselves from the pack.
You have one, speaking of pack, you have one all ACC spot remaining. Baby T, Terquavion Smith, Jarkel Joyner. Who gets the spot?
Oh, man, that's a tough one, because that dude, Jarkel Joyner, has been going crazy these last couple of games.
I had a coach tell me he might be the best defensive guard in the league, which made me raise my eyebrows. Like, he's having a great year.
I mean, they do guard the ball, and he does a really good job on ball. I'm going to have to go with Baby T, though. I think Terquavion Smith is one of those guys that's just so unorthodox. And outside of him getting in foul trouble lately, he has showed up consistently for NC State. You know, for him to come back for a second year and to do what he's doing, he's not only still scoring the ball, but the one thing that I've liked about him is the way that he has improved his scoring, his passing ability. So if there's any guy, I would have to go with Terquavion, even though Jarkel Joyner is right there.
Any beach time in Miami this weekend?
No beach time, man. Josh, I'm all about my business right now. So okay. I'm in and out, man.
Okay. I love that. Well, thank you so much for being generous with your time. It's good to hear your voice, and I hope to see you sometime soon, Joel.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Always.
It's The Drive with Josh Graham, WSJS.
We are going down the stretch on a Friday drive. The final weekend of the college basketball season is upon us, or at least the regular season, even though I know many of the mid-majors having their conference tournaments already. We can't wait. We're going to be out at Duke in North Carolina tomorrow. WD and I will be broadcasting the game right here on WSJS. Not WD and I, but we'll leave that to David Shoemate and company.
We can take a crack at it. Yeah.
Who's the analyst and who's the play-by-play guy? You've done play-by-play more recently than I have.
Yeah.
I've probably done more games in some than you have.
Yeah.
Because I used to travel with teams and doing that a little bit. So we need to figure out if a team will let us
I don't
just
know.
Do one game together. I don't know what sport we'd have the best shot at doing, but basketball, probably.
Yeah.
Baseball.
I feel like baseball or basketball would be our best bet.
You'd be our baseball analyst.
Yeah.
I'd do the play-by-play for baseball.
Uh-huh.
This is our call to the Winston-Salem Dash.
Yeah.
Or the Grasshoppers.
Let's do
or
it.
The Rockers. To have a Josh Graham and Will Dalton broadcast your game night. Maybe ESPN Plus do a game at High Point, even though I know Darren Vaught's kind of locked down that territory. Just a thought, an idea.
Yeah, we could pull it
Maybe
off.
We could do the radio show during a game. Like, we'll tell you what's happening in the game, but it's essentially going to be the radio show.
That's right.
Like, it's an idea. I think there might be some demand for that. We have an audience. We can steer people. Hey, you want to hear our show, but during a baseball game, us trying to broadcast a baseball game while this thing's happening.
That's right. Yeah. 0-1 count. Hey, Bear. There's a, but just go back and forth between pitches,
Get at us. We're fine with that. We're fine with free gear, whatever.
Oh, we love gear.
Throw our way. Now let's recap the week in the most efficient way possible by keeping it simple.
Five words or less.
They're simple, man.
That's all Josh gets to tell you where your favorite teams are at.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Let's keep it simple.
Okay. Before WD throws some things at me to recap, let's get a dance break in here.
This game is over.
Every time I come in the kitchen, you in the kitchen.
Let's go to the sidelines, Tony Haynes.
You Pete got your feet. Head all the way up it.
That's where I first saw Mary.
No.
On that roadside picking blackberries.
Yeah.
I like pig's feet.
It's time to get into some of the things that have happened over the last few days, starting with
UNC. They're starting to heat up, beating UVA and Florida State.
If we're putting those two together, I probably would say Carolina is playing good ball. That's what it is. This is NCAA tournament ball that they're playing. The question is it too little too late? Well, actually, we know it's not too little too late because you win tomorrow, you're going to be in the NCAA tournament. You're playing at Duke. So it is happening at the right time again. Is it the same as what we saw last year, as some people were kind of connecting it to? Oh, they're just flipping the switch again. No, it's not, because aside from Monday where they shot 14 of 29 from three, they are still a bad, objectively bad three-point shooting team. Brady Manek is not walking through that door.
Wake getting beat by
Boston College.
The Deeks have checked out. That's what I saw. You were in the building for it. You heard Steve Forbes after the game say that only two guys out there tried, and it was Ty Appleby and Davion Williamson, who combined for 43 of the 69 nice points that they scored. That's when coaches tell you something like that, believe them. And we'll see how they close the season at Syracuse tomorrow, because there's good reason for the team to be motivated. You came off a stinker. That coach was talking bad about your coach, saying that your program's not doing it the right way, that you've been bought. Oh, Wake Forest, they bought their team. I want to see how motivated Wake plays tomorrow.
Duke beating NC State.
The Devils passed the test. Last year, Wright Thompson had a long ESPN cover story on Coach K, where he was given a lot of access, and he said between a Florida State and Virginia set of wins that they had, Coach K was so pleased with the preparation of his team that was young, like this team is, that John Shire had. He knew that he had built a monster. He was sitting on a monster, a machine, as he called it. This team's playing like a machine, and they're now an old Duke team. When I asked John Shire about that in relation to where Duke, this team, sits, he said he no longer sees a young team Duke has either. They've had real experiences and real tests, and playing NC State was one of those. When the Wolfpack got close a few times at the end, and Duke always had the counterpunch, This is the scariest team in the ACC, and they've passed all the tests, winning five in a row heading into this matchup in Chapel Hill. Regardless of what happens tomorrow night, you should be very worried, or other teams in the ACC and in college basketball should be worried about Duke.
Panthers meeting with Derek Carr and apparently meeting with him again next week.
Carr isn't only short-term. In a sense, he's short-term because he's 32 years old. It's not a long-term, but it goes back to your definition of that. Like, what is your definition of short-term and long-term? And it feels like everybody only views guys who are on the rookie deal as being the long-term options anymore. But the NFL's told us you have to make decisions a lot quicker. Coaches turn over so quickly. The Eagles just won a Super Bowl with two different quarterbacks and two different coaches in a six-year period. Everything's kind of been sped up. Derek Carr, his game doesn't go out of style. He's a pocket passer. So when Frank Reich says, oh, he's a long-term quarterback, we see five great years out of him. Well, he's not lying. But it sounds strange coming out of his mouth. Long-term option at 32? Teddy Bridgewater was 27 when you brought him in. Baker's 27 right now. Sam Darnold was 23. What do you mean that this is a long-term option at 32? Well, 5 years is a long time. And if you get beyond 5 years in the NFL, odds are you've had a successful tenure as a coach.
Mike Bray upsetting Pittsburgh in his final home game at Notre Dame.
The luck of the Irish. 16 missed free throws, WD.
It's not a small amount.
16. Pittsburgh was the number one team in the ACC when they lost to a team that was tied for last, and that was Notre Dame. I'm happy to see it for Mike Bray, who is an ACC legend, but it was the luck of the Irish. And later that night, he went to the linebacker. That's why I'm pretty confident that Notre Dame's going to lose tomorrow at Clemson at Little John Coliseum.
Yeah! Better.
We're working on it.
Uh-huh.
If your coach was out till 2 in the morning on Wednesday night ahead of a Saturday road game and you're already bad in Notre Dame, lock of the century is Clemson tomorrow against Notre Dame. That is a lock of the century.
And lastly, us taste testing lemon Oreos.
Ah! Not terrible, but not great. Not terrible, but not great. It's edible. I could see why people like it. Very Girl Scout cookie-esque. I'm not the biggest Girl Scout cookie fan. I'm not saying this is a rule that applies to everybody, that my taste is the same as your taste. But for me, I ate it. I didn't hate it, but it wasn't great. Like the first time you have a double stuff Oreo cookie.
Oh, maybe double stuff lemon Oreos.
And I'm always reminded of Gary Goldman's comedy anytime I think of double stuff cookies. I'm going to go see Nikki Glaser this weekend in Greensboro. Really excited for that on Sunday. And Gary Goldman had a bit about cookies in general that you can find. And one of the bits was, I remember the first time I had double stuff Oreo cookies, and I said to the cashier, how much more do I owe you? He's like, you don't owe me anything extra. We just gave you double the filling because that's how much we care about you guys at Oreo. Well, mission accomplished. What's next?
That's it.
Oh, one more dance break.
I love great business. Good business. I have tremendous respect for Commissioner Phillips.
That's what's right.
What is your favorite cookie?
Let go!
Don't slam that door.
Excuse me, brother. This is 74th Street Baptist Church, Tennessee.
Boston College.
Bernie Mac making an appearance.
Yeah.
Happy about that.